both a big plus to me and a personal pleasure to be able to introduce Adon Rav Nosson Kamenetsky Shlita. Two of my brothers and myself were able to learn in a yeshiva called Itri, which some of you may have heard of. Tavshin Lamed Aleph was back a few years, and I personally was able to hear a shir on Perek Zul Vagozel from Rav Nosson Kamenetsky, our speaker this evening. And there's no question that Hagon Rav Kamenetsky, who was one of the Miyatsin, one of the founders of that yeshiva, was certainly instrumental in creating a rather fertile environment for many youth who came to Eretz Yisrael at that time. And unquestionably, it's one of the first of the yeshivas, which of course has spawned the whole generation of many American yeshivas today that Baruch Hashem are quite popular. Many years ago, I heard from my Rebbe here, Rav Soloveitchik, from the Bracha, there are two genres of Masorah. There's a Masorah which he called a Masorah Shmiya, a person who listens to Shiurim and is able to hear Divrei Torah from Rabbeim, who themselves are able to hear Torah from their Rabbeim, Midor Lazor, Masorah Moshe Kibol Torah Misinai, Masorah Yeshua, Yeshua Biskeinen, and Chulu. But then there's a second Masorah that he described as a Masorah of Re'iya. That Masorah, he said, is exemplified in Pirkei Avos. Who are your own there? Margul of the Kumne. But that Masorah is primarily founded upon Shimush, with the Gemara says in Brachas, Gedolah Shimush Shal Torah Yosef Limuda, Elisha Hanavi, Eliyahu, his Rebbe, Ashiyat Aknayim Al Yodo. That's a totally different Masorah, one which in many respects is preeminent, and certainly is a prerequisite for leadership. Hazal comment in the context of the Rebbe Shalom looking for a successor to Moshe Rabbeinu, Tasha and Hikos, Yivkar Hashem Elokei Aruchos Bechol Batsa Isha La'edo, Asher Yeti Vesneyan, Asher Yavu Vesneyan, Asher Yosiyan, Asher Yudiyan, Velosi Abbas Hashem Tatsona Asher Elohim Roet. And the Medrash Rabbah points out over there that the one, of course, who succeeded Moshe Rabbeinu is Yeshua Ben Nun, but primarily succeeded Moshe Rabbeinu because he was Mishamesh Moshe Rabbeinu. Well, Yom Mishim Tzapa Oil, the Torah says. And the Medrash Kol Tzapotim, Lo Tzateinu Yom Chalpirya, that he was the one that was responsible for literally setting up the Beis Medrash before the Shir, Paras at the Machtelot, Sider Nassaf Salim, that the Medrash formulated. As a result of that, he became the Mami Yisrael. Rav Soloveitchik was very fond of quoting in the Hakdamah to the Rambam in Mishnah Torah, and based on the Medrash over there as well, the Medrash says there were individuals that were Yotzer Mulachim, the Yoshua Ben Nun, intellectually were more acute than Yoshua, Elazar and Pinchas. But the Rambam writes, "Will Yoshua, Shu Tamil Shemosh Rabbeinu, Masa Tarsh Rabbein Tivo Aleh." Because of his Shimush, because of that ability to be Mishamesh, Moshe Rabbeinu, he was able to become the Nami Yisrael. Rav Kamenetsky clearly has both of these two genres of Masorah, both the Masorah of Shemiya and the Masorah of Re'iya. He was also in his own right to be a Magashir for many, many years, and obviously grew up in the house of one of the Dolei Hador, Hagaon of Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky Zatzal. If any Masorah is missing today, it's still that second Masorah. It almost is non-existent, and probably many of the problems that we have with Maneinu Anu, I would say I can be traced to the fact that we're lacking in that Masorah. We have a Masorah of Shmiya, and one can say that, Pshuto Kamashmo, today, given the technology that's available, people hearing Shurim all day, all night, Baruch Hashem, Ken Yirbo, but Nisad Sheni, the second Masorah of Shimush, is almost totally lacking. And that has spawned also many, many problems and problematica in our generation that are mind-boggling. And therefore, when I heard already a number of years ago that the Sefer, as I call it, The Making of a Gadol, was going to be published, I was very excited. And as I mentioned last night, to me, that Sefer is one of the most remarkable stories that has been published in the last 50 years of this genre. And I feel personally indebted to Rav Kamenetsky and hope that Hashem will continue to publish the remaining volumes, so we can actually get full insight into his father, Hadron of Kamenevsky, and many other Gedolim of the previous generation who came into contact with Hadron of Kamenevsky. I want to be Makir Tov this evening to Jeff Rockwagner, because it was basically he who spearheaded this entire event this evening, and he actually pushed it in every direction, imaginable and unimaginable, and there's no question we owe him a really hakarat hatov for the fact that Baruch Hashem tonight we have the great chus of hearing Haragon, Harav Nosson Kamenevsky, Shlita. Tonight is on the theme of the closing of the Volozhin Yeshiva. I will describe in a few words what happened on that morning of February 2nd, 1892. Hei Shvat Tafresh Nun Beis. That morning the yeshiva building was surrounded by government officials and policemen from the whole county, not only from the city, from the entire county, together with a lot of just going from the surrounding farms. They were afraid that the Jews may stand up against them, so they organized that a lot of going sang around to make sure that the Jews don't rebel. And the governor of the area went into the yeshiva, and in the presence of all of the yeshiva and the talmidim, they read out an order by the Russian government that the yeshiva should be closed, and the talmidim are to leave within 3 days. They're not supposed to leave the town. And after the sefer Torahs and the sfarim were removed, they put a seal on the door, a seal that was a government stamp, that no one should dare enter the building anymore. This was the closing that took place on February 2nd, 1892. My talk tonight is divided into two. One part is about Volozhin as the mother yeshiva, and the second part is the closure itself. In the book that Rabbi David mentioned, the making of a Gadol, has a lot of material on this. Of course, you know that the book was banned. I don't know if you heard about it. But last Shabbos, Adam and Rabbi Sternbuch, Rabbi Moshe Sternbuch, he's a dying gay, and he reads in the Shamlai, the other signatories on the ban. He's pressing his time against the book. And I got an idea there, and they gave me Shlishi, and I walked over to give him a Yashar Koach, so he tells me which page he is up to. And after davening, he tells me that, how do I know that the Koyden of a Hasidim said this is bad about the Mitzvah of Holanda? So I said, read the book, said my father told me this. So how do your father know about Koyden of a Hasidim when you're misnapping? Anyway, he is reading the book very, very carefully, very meticulously. As a matter of fact, he tells someone that he spent the whole Hashanah Rabbah night reading pages of a book. That was his secret. Anyway, in order to please everyone, I published, this is the cover of it, Making of a Gadol, improved edition. Unfortunately, it's not as rude, it's only improved.
actually what I will speak about tonight is found in various parts of my unimproved book and of my improved book. But, like a Dvar Torah, there's a Gemara in the beginning of Chagiga that Rabbi Yeshua said, he asked two Talmidim of the Yeshiva of Yavne, Rabbi Yochanan ben Breiko, Rabbi Lozoch Chisma, he asked them what was said in the Beis Medrash this past Shabbos. So they said, we want to hear better what you have to say, as if there's nothing, no Chiddush there. So Rabbi Yeshua said, no. E'efshem Beis Medrash b'loi Chiddush. And Beis Medrash has to have a Chiddush. It's impossible. Similarly, when I was preparing to speak to you tonight, even though it's something that I wrote about in my life, but E'efshem Beis Medrash b'loi Chiddush. So my talk tonight won't be completely found in the making of a Gadol. Everyone knows that the Volozhin Yeshiva was the mother Yeshiva. What does that mean? It means that it was the Yeshiva which, the first Yeshiva that opened after many years when there were no Yeshivas in Lithuania. Of course, there was a lot of Torah, and people learned in the Shtibla and the towns and so on, but a Yeshiva center which would attract students who come from all over, with its own administration and its own Rosh Yeshiva, was something new, and it was opened by the Rabbi Volozhin, Rav Chaim Volozhiner. Rav Chaim Volozhiner was the, we call Rav Chaim Volozhiner, he's actually called Rav Chaim Yitzchakim, father of Yitzchak, but he's known as Rav Chaim of Volozhin, where he was up. He was the prime talmid of the Vilna Gaon, and he opened the yeshiva in 1802, just over 200 years ago. This is the accepted year of the yeshiva's opening, although in official Russian government papers pertaining to its closure 90 years later, is the government papers that refers to the date of its opening as 1805. Now the book, the comprehensive book on Rav Chaim Volozhiner, Avi HaYeshivos by Dov Eliak, he said that on the building it says that the year Tov Kuf Samal Gimel, which is like the end of 1802, and there's a letter which Rav Chaim Volozhiner wrote, the Aseret Yemei Teshuva, of the beginning of Tov Kuf Samal Gimel, which was still 1802, that he's referring in the letter, he's referring to the opening of the yeshiva. In those years, we can't imagine us living, coming from the United States, coming from the Western countries, and even living in Israel, that the government had a tight control over everything, and if the yeshiva was open, it was open secretly, because there were laws in the country that 10 people couldn't get together for anything. So the yeshiva was open, the government didn't become aware of it until 3 years later. That's why in their papers it said that the yeshiva opened in 1805. Now, how did Rav Chaim Volozhiner go about opening the yeshiva? He of course discussed this with his rebbe, the Vilna Gaon. And Rav Shach said that the Gaon took 3 years after the idea was raised. It took 3 years for the Gaon to finally approve it. Now, according to this sefer Avi HaYeshivos about Rav Chaim Volozhiner, Rav Chaim Volozhiner is the one who brought up the idea of opening a yeshiva. But Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, the Chassid Lubavitcher, the brother of the Rebbe, who we just mentioned in his introduction of me. So Rav Aaron Soloveitchik told me as follows. He said, Rav Itzale, that's Rav Itzale of Volozhin, the son of Rav Chaim Volozhin, who was 17 years old when the Vilna Gaon died. The year the Vilna Gaon died was 17. So So Rabbi Yitzchak wanted to study medicine in his youth. That's what he said. And of course, as Aaron Soloveitchik added, in order to heal the Jewish sick. Now, inasmuch as the medical schools were located in Italy, Rabbi Yitzchak studied and mastered both Italian and Latin from translations of Tanakh. When his father learned of the youth's wayward ideas, he told the Vilna Gaon, who advised Reb Chaim to set up a yeshiva. And later Reb Chaim Volozhiner was to say, I cemented my Yitzhale into the yeshiva. Chabad Ein Gimoya into the yeshiva. Now, we should assume that both stories are right. The Baal Soloveitchik story, the Baal Soloveitchik stems from Reb Chaim Volozhiner. His grandfather, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, was named for his predecessor, Reb Chaim Volozhiner. So we should assume that what Reb Chaim Soloveitchik said was true. On the other hand, Reb Chaim also had a Masora, and it took 3 years. So I believe that at the age of 14, Reb Chaim got wind of what his son Yitzchak wanted to do. At the age of 14, he already had plans to be a doctor. And he raised this problem with the Vilna Gaon, that he wants to be a doctor, Asher presented. And it took 3 years for the Vilna Gaon to say, set up a yeshiva. And that way, you'll safeguard that Rabbi Yitzchak should remain in the world of Torah. Now, this proves, and this is something that I reached, the conclusion that I reached as I was preparing this lecture, that at the very beginning of the founding of yeshivas, a yeshiva was to be run by family. And that's the way yeshivas were run throughout the history. It's an embarrassing point that a yeshiva will not necessarily be transferred to the biggest slum, but to another member of the family. The story proves it. And this is the way it's been going on ever since the yeshiva. In the Sabbati yeshiva, where my father studied, Sabbati yeshiva was founded 80 years after the mother yeshiva, in 1882, my father studied there. It was headed by the Rosh Hashiva, Moshe Martin Epstein, and the Mashgiach. The Mashgiach really brought in the Rosh Hashiva, the Nassim Tzvi Finkel, the author of Sabbatke, for my name is for Nassim. And when he wanted to appoint his son, the Moshe Finkel, the author of Sabbatke, wanted to appoint him in 1912 to be a Magachir in the Yeshiva, so Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg was 3 days. He was considered to be the greatest founder of the Sabbat Yeshiva, and Rabbi Chaim Steiner told me he would have been the Gadol Hadar of that generation, but for the fact that he divorced his wife. So in those years, the only people who divorced their wives would be a Balagola, simple people. But a Rav had to chew, that's the expression, bite in the pyramid, chew the quill, chew his quill, chew under the covers and stick it out with his wife. He divorced his wife, and that's why he wasn't recognized anymore. But he was, in fact, you know, from his form, the Sliya Yesh, was the greatest Talmud of Sabbat in the generation. And he brought up this point to Rav Nosson Tzvi Finkel. And he said, why are you appointing your son? He would have heard my lecture, would have said very simply, this is the way of the what if the author of Sabbat answer? He said like this, my Yetzer Tov enticed me to oppose the appointment in order, A, to overcome the instinctive love of the father for his children. It's a kind of an instinct that a person has to be able to control. So this way, if he would appoint someone else, he'd be overcoming, he'd be breaking his instinct. and B, to remove suspicion from himself. But he said, I was compelled to nominate him because he could buttress my Musar mode and preserve the unique character of the yeshiva. He would have been considered for the post even if he had not been related to me. And I saw myself obligated to overcome my yetzer tov in this matter and appoint him. Now, this story is written out in the Tnuas HaMusa. That's the study of the Musar movement by Rodolphe Kainz, who lived on the Chavam Alot in Jerusalem. I visited him when I came for my first time and visited Israel in 1965. He was a son-in-law of Rav Zev Gold, the famous Mizrahi leader, and he wrote a many-volume anthology of the Musar movement. So he writes it. But a letter that Rav Weinberg wrote after the book was published, he wrote a letter to Rav Dov Katz to fill in on things that existed in the book. So this letter is at the end of Rav Dov Katz's son. He has a son living in Malay Adumim, and he has the letter. And he writes in there as follows. The altar brought up a criticism against Kellan, the Muslim Jews, that it practiced nepotism. So Rabbi Weinberg says, as I spoke up saying to the altar that he was governing Sabotka in the same manner. And the altar raised the silver cane as if to hit me, and I ran out of the house. Then he sent a messenger, Rabbi Avraham Kozinski, who was my uncle later. My father and he married two sisters. He was a big Talmud of the altar of Sabotka. So he came to my room to prove that in his case it was done without self-interest. When he explained the matter to me, I told the messenger that he had convinced me. But Rav Avraham Kozinski said that the altar instructed him to spend 2 hours convincing me. And since 2 hours had not yet passed, he had to repeat everything again to make sure I properly understood what he told me. This is what Rev Weinberg wrote to the author of Tnuas HaMusa. Now, somebody told me very recently, this is in the improved edition, on November 21st, 2003, that Rav Yitzchak Chaim was told by Rabbi Weinberg, this is the very one, Rabbi Weinberg was in Switzerland after the war, he told them that when the branch of Sabotkin Yeshiva was built in 1924 in Hebron, the Hebron Yeshiva was built by the Sabotkin Yeshiva, I won't go into the reason why, but when that was built, and Reb Moshe Mortzel, the Rosh Yeshiva, went over to Palestine then, from Lithuania, in order to build up this branch of the Sabotka in the city of Hebron, then of course it was. And he brought his son-in-law, who was Reb Chaim Simon's father, Pascal Simon, the son-in-law of Moshe Mortzel. So he said, Rabbi Weinberg told him that when this branch was being set up, there was a discussion as to which staff member should be transferred from Sabotka to that choice post where Moshe Mortzel was going. And after concluding that his son, Reb Meisher Finkel, was best suited, and he wrote down all the qualities that's needed and all that, the summary was that his son Reb Meisher should be sent to Eretz Yisrael. You have to understand that the Litvakis were very staunch Zionists. And in order to have an opportunity to move from Lithuania to Eretz Yisrael, everyone would jump at that chance. So this was a choice, the posting. And after he made the whole cheshbon, who should be sent? So he concluded that his son Meisher should be sent. The fearing that the decision of the safe on self-interest, he tore up the paper and started the liberation again. Again, he reached the conclusion that the Meisher Finkel should go to Eretz Yisrael. And he tore up a second time. It's only after the third try did he say, well, we have to let it stand. By some Rabbi Yishai, he'll be the one going to Eretz Yisrael. So when Rabbi Weinberg told the story, he added that he was moved by self-interest and action. It seems that Rabbi Radzinsky's session 12 years earlier had failed in spite of having repeated his master Yaakov Habakkuk's instruction. But as I said, something to be ashamed of. He could have said, yeshivas are transferred to the children. This is the way it's been since the very founding of the Volozhin Yeshiva. When the Prime Volozhin established the Volozhin Yeshiva, he issued a call that yeshivas be set up in other towns too. In fact, in 1808, 6 years after Volozhin Yeshiva was founded, Blumkes Klois, there was a shul called Blumkes, because a lady, Blumke Bilenkin, is the one who founded this shul. So yeshiva was set up in Minsk, in Blumkes Klois yeshiva. There was a lot of Torah in Minsk, from the time, in the middle of the 18th century, from the time of the Shagatayim, with different shuls, maintaining respective level groups of Talmidim, which I know about, because my father came to that outstanding city of Minsk, the capital of Belarus, to study in 90 from his little town. He came to learn there in 1902. He was 11 years old at the time, and he would sleep on the benches of the shul, and there in Minsk. But Blumkes Klois became a focal point for Bachman to travel to from other towns. And it was operated by an administration and a Rosh Yeshiva. It was set up as a yeshiva back in 1808. I want to diverge for a moment to tell you about an episode at which I was not present, but was reported to me by an activist in Be'er HaGola. I don't know if you're familiar with this organization. It's an organization for Russian Jews who moved to America, And they're the ones, my father was behind it. As soon as the movement of Jews to America started, and of course the Russian Jews knew nothing, as you know that, they knew nothing about Yiddishkeit, and the children knew even less. So, in order to build educational institutions, yeshivas, where Russian children, Jewish children coming from Russia, should learn. So my father was behind the whole inception of the Be'er HaGola, and I was told this in this episode by Ben Safer, who lived in Shari Chesed, who was one of the major founders of Be'er HaGola, and he recalled that at a dinner of Be'er HaGola, just a couple of years after it was founded, so a child, an 11-year-old boy from Minsk, said at Dvar Torah. And he said it in Russian, of course. My father knew Russian. And after the boy said his Dvar Torah, my father got up to speak. And my father told how when he was a child, and he lived in this town, Dolhino, after the mass Jewish immigration began to the Western world, to America, and there were some people, some Jews, who moved from Dolhino to America, and they didn't make it, and they came back to the little town, and they brought the children back. Now these children had already gone to public school in America. So the other Jewish children were told by the parents not to play with those kids coming back from America, because after all, they picked up some evil influences in the trade of Medina, in the forbidden country of America. And my father said then, when he was speaking at this Be'er HaGola dinner, he was cautioning religious American Jews not to reject their co-religionists arriving from Russia now that the shoe is on the other foot. And then my father said, he described Minsk, the city where this little 11-year-old boy had come from. And he told them, there were 600 people in the audience, and he told the people what Minsk was like. It had 83 shuls, and in many of the shuls there were boys sleeping on the benches, studying Torah and Balabatim, who would feed the youngsters. And he told about the the seven charities in the city, the support for the poor, hospitality for the sick. They didn't have a hospital there yet. The people would provide for the sick who are laid up in their home. There was, of course, the Free Loan Society. There was redemption of captives. They called it Pidyon Shvuyim. What it means is that when someone was drafted and scripted and they were able to pay, to bribe the officials to free him from the army, this is called Pidyon Shvuyim. Dollars for bribes, tuition for poor students, money taken for food for Pesach. So my father described what a city Minsk was like with its Torah and its Chesed. And he concluded, all of Minsk was destroyed by the communists and then the Nazis. All that remains Minsk is this little boy. And it wasn't the dry in the whole audience. Anyway, the first yeshiva that listened to the Chaim Volozhiner's call and set up a yeshiva, the first city, was Minsk, Lumkas Kloy Yeshiva. In 1865, a fire destroyed the Volozhiner Yeshiva, and the Rav of Krynik sent a letter to Minsk, the leader of Minsk Jewry, and he told and he repeated to them what had happened when the Lumkas Kloy Yeshiva was founded, and he described it all, and he says that Rav Chaim Volozhiner sent 10 of his best Talmidim in order to establish the branch, we'll call it, the daughter yeshiva of the mother yeshiva, the first one in Minsk. He was writing back to Minsk, because Minsk had many wealthy Jews, and he wanted them to participate warmly in the rebuilding of the Volozhiner yeshiva building. This Lumkas Kloy yeshiva was 1808. In 1815, the Mir Yeshiva was established, all because of the call of Chaim Volozhiner. And the Mir Yeshiva is now the oldest yeshiva in the world. You probably heard of Avram Kalmanovich, Avad Hatzalah fame. He saved the Mir Yeshiva and supported it while it was during the Second World War years in Shanghai. And he said, that the reason why the Mir Yeshiva, of all the yeshivas existing at the outbreak of the Second World War, why it was the Mir Yeshiva that was saved? Because it was the oldest yeshiva. And just like in the destruction of the first temple, the Chomash and Magir, 11 years before it was destroyed, the Talmidei Chachamim, the learners, were exiled into Babylonia. And they set up Torah over there as a forerunner to the exile of the entire Jewish people into Babel, through Nebuchadnezzar. They were sent in advance to set up Torah, to set up Yeshiva. In the second day, Samigdash, before it was destroyed, Rabbi Yochanan of ben Zakkai saved Yavne to send the Torah should continue in its form and its Masorah. In spite of the destruction of the Second Beit HaMikdash, and similarly, Sedrat Kalmanovich, because of the great Churban of the Holocaust, so the Mir Yeshiva was sent out to be saved because it had the schus of being the oldest yeshiva. Now, in America, the Mir Yeshiva is run by Rav Kalmanovich's family. He had an official title in the, he was called the Nasi of the Yeshiva. Of course, here the Mir Yeshiva is run by the Rosh Yeshiva, the Rosh Yeshiva Mir was Rav Kamai, and Rav Lezer Yudel Finkel was his son-in-law, and then Rav Benish Finkel, and now Rav Nachum Tzvi Finkel was the son-in-law of Rav Benish Finkel. It goes going down through the generations in the family. And as I said, the yeshiva should go in the family. And I hope the children of Avraham Kalmanovich understand, like what Rav Kalmanovich would have done. He was a great publicist. Rav Kalmanovich, if he would have been alive some 10 years from now, 2015, He would celebrate a bais on any of the Miri Yeshiva, established 1860. And I hope they also celebrate this landmark event, the Yeshiva, the oldest Yeshiva in existence now, is almost 200 years old. It will be 200 years in 2015. Now, it's a remarkable thing. For 70 years, no more yeshivas were established. No famous yeshivas were established. Reb Chaim Volozhiner died in 1821, 6 years after the Miri Yeshiva was founded. And obviously, his son, Reb Yitzchak, instead of becoming a doctor, took over the yeshiva. He wasn't so enthused about spreading the gospel of yeshiva building, and yeshivas weren't built anymore until the Talmidim of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter started building yeshivas as an expression of the Muslim movement. That's why it took so many years for other yeshivas to be built. I'm going to mention three yeshivas: Telz, Slabotka, and Radin. The reason why I mention these three yeshivas that were established in the 1880s, because later I'll speak about how these yeshivas reacted to the closing of Volozhin. But these three yeshivas were established, let's start first with Telz, because Reb Nosson Tzvi Finkel, who was a Talmud of the prime Talmud of the Yisrael Kalanta. It's not that three major Talmudim. That Simcha Zitzel of Kelan and Reb Itzel of Petersburg. He was, the capital then wasn't Moscow, but it was St. Petersburg. And now it's Leningrad, now it's called St. Petersburg again. He was the Rav of the capital, and he was a Talmud of Reb Yisrael Kalanta. They called him the Bitzel Tesselburger. And another third Talmud of Pasadi Amsterdam. But Reb Nosson Tzvi Finkel, the Alter Chaluki, he was already a Talmud of the Simcha Zitzel. He's a Talmud of the Talmud of Reb Yisrael Salanta. So Reb Nosson Tzvi Finkel, he was born in 1849, the same year that the Bitzale of Balozh died. That's when the Alter of Chaluki was born. He started the Tel Yeshiva when he was a young man of 32 years old, in 1881. Not that he went to Telz, but he organized the yeshiva and sent Talmidim there, and he got the monetary support for it. That was 1881. But in the Sma Yeshiva, 3 years later, in 1884, was when the Blazer Gordon, he came to Telz, he became the Rav, and that's when the yeshiva took off and became one of the major yeshivas. But that Telz was 1881, it counts, it's the beginning, from 1881. A year later, 1882, that's when the Nosson Tzvi Finkel himself started a yeshiva in Slabotka as part of the Kovna Kola. What does it mean, Kovna Kola? The Kola, it's not like Aryeh Kola now, where Talmidim get together and learn the same subjects and things like that. It was an organization that supported married young men to learn. There could be three married men learning in one shul, three in another town. And this organization called Kovna Kola supported them. Why? Before that, wealthy people would take sons-in-law who were Talmidei Chachamim. They would support them while they advanced and developed in Torah. But since times changed and people started taking not Talmidei Chachamim, but the lawyers and accountants, for sons of mom. So then the community undertook, this is the Rabbi Salanto's idea, that now the community has to undertake to support these outstanding in the life who will become great Rabbanim, etc. So this is the Kovna Kola. So the author of Slabotka, he was a young man then, he was 33 years old in 1882, so he said that the Kola was like, this was for a few years already. So he said to one of the leaders of the Kollel, who was another Talmud of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, Rabbi Pepper Burger, and he told him, just like you have to train young people to become Rabbonim, you have to train some young people to become Rashi Yeshivas. So the cost of covering four boys, four unmarried boys, is a famous card taking in one married fellow. So therefore, they took in a boy, 4, 8, 12, decided a yeshiva, under the auspices of the Kovna Kola. That was 1882. In 1889, they already took the Rome Rosh Yeshiva, they became an independent yeshiva, Sabotki yeshiva. But it counts its establishment from 1882. Now Rabin has various dates that it counts its is the beginning from. It's an interesting thing. There's a very good book, Bishvilei Rabin, of Rabin Yeshiva, and it has over there a picture of a receipt from the Rabin Yeshiva, a receipt book. So it says it like this, it says in Hebrew and in English, for the American domain. So in Hebrew it says it was established in Tof Reish Chav Dalet, that's 1864. In the English it says it's established in 5642, 1882, and in parentheses 1864. Now, just the dates don't gel. Now, so studying the history of the Rabbi Yeshiva, it seems as follows. The Chafetz Chaim lived in Rabbi, a private person. The people heard of the Talmud Chacham, so people came to live there, to learn there, and so on, because they had the Chafetz Chaim there. He lived there in Rabbi from 1869. It's not a yeshiva, it's a Rosh Hashiva. When his daughter got married, he married his daughter off to a young man, Rav Hirsch Levinson, in 1885. That's when the yeshiva was started. And together with his son-in-law, who died in 1921, died 12 years before his father-in-law. And the Rabbi Yeshiva was still in exile for the First World War, even though the war was over in 1918, but the Russian communist government didn't allow people to go back to Poland. They were still stuck in Russia, and it was the cold winter, and this tzaddik, Rav Hirsch Levinson, gave away his boots to a Talmud whose shoes were torn, and he took the Talmud's torn shoes, and he got sick that winter, and when he died, the Chofetz Chaim had a suffix whether he's permitted to say Hesper on him. Maybe it's considered like a suicide. Interesting question. But he died in 1921. This son-in-law of the Chofetz Chaim, who had actually started the Rabbi Yeshiva with his father-in-law. Now let's get back to Voloshin. Revitzaleh was the Rosh Yeshiva from 1821 till he died in 1849. That's for 28 years. 9 years longer than his father, Rav Chaim Voloshiner, was the Rosh Yeshiva from 1802 to 1821. He was already 28 years. After he died, so who became Rosh Yeshiva? A son-in-law of his? Rebbe Eliezer Fried, who lived only 4 more years, and then another son-in-law of Rebbe Yitzchak, who was Rebbe Herschleit Berlin. This is the Nitzi, Naftali Tzvi Yehuda, that's the acronym of Nitzi, Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, and the Yiddish are called Hersch, like Tzvi is Hersch, and Yehuda is Leib, Rebbe Herschleit. The Nitzi will call the Nitzi. He became the Rosh Hashiva, and he became in 1853, he became Rosh Hashiva at the age of 36, and he was the Rosh Hashiva till the Yeshiva closed down. He reigned for 39 years, 11 years longer than his predecessor. In 1880, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, who was married to the Nesiv's granddaughter, was given the powers of assistant Rosh Yeshiva. Like when Yeshiva himself had been, or his father-in-law had still been alive, yet he wasn't a Rosh Yeshiva, he was an assistant, he was a Rashiya and Yeshiva. And in 1880, the Chaim Soloveitchik was appointed to be assistant Rosh Yeshiva in Balash. This was the story of the Lajan, the mother yeshiva, and its daughters. Only two daughters it actually had. And then there were other yeshivas that were built, not as daughters of the Lajan, but because of the Bishkol Salanto's influence, and the influence of his Talmidim, the Simcha Zissel, and the Mitzvah Temple Buddha, through the altar of Slavonika. Rav Shach once told me that all the Torah that's in existence in the world now is thanks to the altar of Slavonika. He was speaking then to me about Moshe Reichman, the wealthy Reichman from Toronto. There was a time they were paying off all the debts of the yeshiva in Israel. I don't remember which year it was. But if I look it up in the making of the Bible, I find the exact year. That Rav Shach told me that the altar of Slobodkin was the money that he got from somebody, Obadiah Lachman, a wealthy man from Berlin. With his money, he's responsible for all the Torah in existence now. And he says, maybe now, with the money from Reichman, history will repeat itself. This is what Rav Shach tells me personally. Now we get to the second part of my lecture about the closure of the Lashon. Having shown that yeshiva from the inception are private fiefdoms handed over to family members, we are faced with two problems. One problem is, how can the level of scholarship be maintained when children are not necessarily as learned as the predecessors, the antecedents? So how do you maintain it? If it involves staying in the family, so how can we make sure that the level of scholarship will be maintained? The answer to this problem is that the laws of inheritance change in the issue. Instead of sons inheriting the posts from their fathers, the daughters began to inherit them. What do I mean? Not that the daughters became Rosh Yeshiva, but the daughter's husband, whom naturally the father would handpick, and he would take the bigger slum. And the Yerusha and Yeshiva transferred, instead of being given over from father to son, is given over from father-in-law to son-in-law. And my father used to say that. He said, from Ravitzel Elohim is time, inheritance goes to sons-in-law, not to sons. And this is the way it was with yeshiva, with rabbinic positions in Lithuania. The son-in-law was the Yorish, not the son. So we solved the problem, how to maintain the level of scholarship. But there's another problem, a second problem, and that problem is unfortunately insoluble. What if there are several family members who are worthy of becoming Rosh Yeshiva? How can in-family squabbling be avoided? And unfortunately, it can. Time doesn't permit us to delve into the reasons for the closure of the Lashon. Everyone knows the tradition that the Russian government wanted to bring in secular studies into the curriculum of the yeshiva, and the Russian yeshiva refused, so the government closed the yeshiva down. But few people know about the other reason, which some books have as a major reason why the yeshiva closed. There was a family squabble. The Nitzi, 75 years old, who had inherited the yeshiva from his father-in-law. He wanted to retire and move to Eretz Yisrael, as his father had done several decades earlier. Like I said, Yitzchak and the Zionists. Reb Chaim Berlin was a son of the Nasi, and he had been brought in Moscow. He was only 15 years younger than his father, because the Nasi married at the age of 14. And his son, Reb Chaim Berlin, you may have learned in the yeshiva of Chaim Berlin in America, Chaim Berlin was a son of the Nasi, of Reb Naftali Meher Schleid Berlin. And he wanted, the Nasi wanted to hand over the head of the yeshiva, the head of the yeshiva, to his son, Reb Chaim Berlin. But many Talmidim, you might say, even most of the Talmidim possibly, wanted the assistant Rosh Yeshiva, the nephew of Reb Chaim Berlin. It's all in the family, remember. The nephew of Reb Chaim Soloveitchik to become the Rosh Yeshiva. And it's no difference what the principles themselves, what they held, if they were part of the squabble. If the Talmidim themselves fought among themselves, someone to this one, someone to the other one, naturally the yeshiva couldn't go on. The fighting reached such a level that some Talmidim stole Reb Chaim Berlin's lulav and esrog. And Reb Chaim Soloveitchik was the one that threatened the boys with expulsion. And they were returned to Dalet Minim, and as a result, the windows of Reb Chaim Soloveitchik's house were broken. You know, there are disputes in present-day yeshivas too. For example, in the Polish yeshiva, there's a lot of fighting going on. A dispute between a son of Rav Avraham Kahneman, of course, the one who built the yeshiva was the old Panevish Rav, and he left an only son, Rav Avraham Kahneman, and he has a son and a son-in-law, and there's fighting over there. Who should be the Rosh Yeshiva? The son of Rav Avraham Kahneman or the son-in-law? And recently, one of the adversaries, who was a Kohen, was Duchening, and they didn't see the Arbanim, they stole his shoes. This happened in Volozhin. They're following the old Volozhin tradition of battling who the Rosh Yeshiva should be. In the Hebron Yeshiva, there was a Vilna Machlokes about 25 years ago between Reb Chaim Sana, the only son of the Chasva Sana, I mentioned earlier, who came to Israel together with his father-in-law, Rabbi Shamor Tehefsky, in 1924, to found the Hebron Yeshiva. So his son, Reb Chaim Sana, had a machlokes with other members of the family. So the children of another son-in-law of Rabbi Shamor Tehefsky, the Hebroni family, as who should be Rosh Yeshiva. The Hebron machlokes was resolved because for about 25 years. Rosh Shach incidentally said then that the only one who could really resolve it properly was my father, Chanan Bracha. My father was too old to participate in it. Why did Rosh Shach say that my father? Because my father knew the history of Slobodka, the history of Hebron, so well that he could adjudicate who the yeshiva really belongs to. But that's Rosh Shach said at that time. But they resolved the problem, and Reb Chaim Sana took the building in Geula, the Hebron Yeshiva in Geula, and the rest of the family took the Yeshiva in Givat Mordechai, and that problem was resolved. But in Panevesh, there's still a machlokes going on, and we don't know how this will end. But just imagine, if the Panevesh Yeshiva would have to shalom close down, what a trauma the Jewish world would experience. So we can imagine what a trauma the Jewish world experienced when the Volozhin Yeshiva was closed down in 1892. All the more so because when the Volozhin Yeshiva closed down, besides the Mir Yeshiva, the only old established yeshiva, I said there was the other yeshivas, Pels, Rabin, Sabotkin, they were less than a decade old. And now the mother yeshiva, the lodge closed down. So let us examine how dramatic was the closure of a lodge in those three yeshivas, Pels, Rabin, and Sabotkin. held yeshiva seem to have been most affected. Why do I say that? Because half a year later, in the Chol HaMoed of Sukkot, this is written up. Written up in 1927. Written up, a play was put on by the Telz Talmidim about the closure of Halashon, Chol HaMoed Sukkot. And the Rosh Hashiva was so moved by it that he put it up, put it on again the night of Shmini Atzeres. And the whole day is Shana Rabba. How did he spend his day in Shana Rabba? He spent the whole day in Shana Rabba setting up the stage and the props for the play to be repeated in his own house the night of Shmini Atzeres. And the way he described here what happened was the play was a kind of a part morality play. A morality play is a dramatized allegory with its characters abstractions. Abstractions are the characters. Now the characters in this play were the Netziv, some Talmidim, and the Talmud was a character, and the Talmud was a child of the Ben Yochid, an only child of the Torah. And the mother, the Torah, the child of God, is another character. And Knesset Yisrael, and Eliyahu HaNavi. They are the characters in this morality play describing the closure of the Halashon. The first thing has, when the curtain is raised, it has the Talmidim sitting and learning, and the Mashgiach walking down the aisle, checking that everyone is learning, and the Netziv is standing there with a smile on his face, enjoying the way the Talmidim are learning, a simcha shel mitzvah, and suddenly walks in the governor and the goyim and everyone, and the announcement that the yeshiva has to be closed, and so on, and then the Netziv falls down the thing, and the curtain drops. The second scene has the Netziv and the Talmidim are trying to comfort him. That one Talmud speaks and the Netziv responds, and a different Talmud speaks and a different Talmud speaks. The Netziv is inconsolable. The third scene has a young man, the Talmud, lying in bed, ailing and beseeching God to save him. The Talmud is praying, the Talmud, and he's, I'm going to read some 10 lines, and let me read them first in Yiddish, and then I'm going to pray for you. He's saying, Ich Talmud, shtar ob von der Welt, ich muss schon gehen in ewigen Gefell, ich muss von der Welt weggehen, und teurer mein Mutter, lassen allein. Mutter, als ihr soll auf den Himmel erreicht, bleibst du doch wie eine Schramme an der Buch. Bitte, Mutter, Gott von mir, ich stehe doch schön beim Tier. Knefisch ist vorher, wo doch ich hier. He's saying, I come and I'm dying from this world. I must go to my eternal tent. I must leave this world and tell on my mother leave abandoned. Mother dear, if I go to heaven, you will remain as a soul without a body. Pray, Mother, to God for me. I'm standing at the gate. Knefisch ist vorher. How am I leaving her? How will she survive without me? Talmud is saying Torah can't exist without Talmud. The fourth, and then in the same scene, we have the mother speaking. The mother is pictured as an old wise woman with the word MS written on her forehead, and she's carrying a candle, and she's crying about what's happening to her ailing son, that his son is about to go leave this world. The fourth scene has Knesset Yisrael, also an old woman, wizened, full of wrinkles, And on one hand she's carrying a Sefer Torah, and the other hand a cane, a wandering cane, with a backpack that is wandering from Eretz Yisrael, wandering from country to country. And she's also crying to God, trying to save the Talmud, trying to save the Torah. The last thing has the Netziv standing at the grave of the Chaim Volozhin. And they show a monument, but it says he is buried the Chaim of Volozhin, and the Netziv is there, and he's praying at the grave. And he puts down the key, one of the lines is he puts down the key to the building, and he says, here is the key to your yeshiva, go unlock it, don't sleep, Zayda, your yeshiva is closed, my strength is waning. And he saints again, and the curtain drops, and it lifts up again, and who's there with the Netziv? Eliyahu HaNavi is there with the Netziv. And Eliyahu HaNavi, of course, writes the comfort and the song, and the play has, Eliyahu HaNavi says, God has opened another spring which will for Jews provide life as long as your yeshiva will be missing. And until God will unlock it, and then both springs will flow with life. Which new spring is the place speaking about? The Tel Yeshiva, of course. And later they name it. And the Leon Navi says to the deceased, give you blessing to tell, and I'll say amen, and he gives a blessing, and the Leon Navi says amen, and the whole choir says amen, as if Telz is replacing Volozhin, and saying that if Volozhin reopens, so there'll be two springs. It's very interesting. The play doesn't mention anything about the cause, of the closure of Volozhin. Not the Russian government, which no one wants to bring up in Russia, and neither the Inn family squabbling, which I spoke about before. There's no cause mentioned. Yeshiva is closed, and Talmud is on a deathbed unless and other yeshivas will open. This is the play, and Tel took the closure of Volozhin very seriously. The one who describes it, the one who quotes the whole line, it was written, the whole play was written about 18-year-old Talmud of Tel. In 1927, when this was written out, there were many copies in Lithuania, and this Talmud had become a respectable rub in Lithuania. And he told how, when he was there, when the show when it was put on, the way everyone was so moved, the way Talmidim were crying, and the Mashiach were crying about the closing of Talmud, the closing of Volozhin. Talmud took it very badly. What about Ram? Ram seemed to be effective, but to a lesser degree than Telz. I found that the Chafetz Chaim was once telling the story of the closing of Volozhin, and he tells that the he is really speaking about the cause, and he says the Rosh Hashivah of Volozhin preferred to decided to close the yeshiva rather to bring in secular studies. And the Chafetz Chaim said, had they permitted bringing in secular studies, it would have caused Torah in its unadulterated form to be forgotten from among Jewish people. And once they disallowed it, yeshiva without secular studies open, which later became fortresses of Torah in our generation. Like a blocked spring, the Torah found other routes and trails by which to burst forth once it was obstructed in Volozhin. He uses that muscle from the play, and he says it's like a spring, and you can't block up a spring. If you block up one exit for the water, it'll burst out some other place. And this is the spring of Torah. In other words, it wasn't such a tragic event cosmological, it's like a spring. And it'll go, it'll open somewhere else. And on the contrary, it'll open in another, it should be. The son-in-law of the Chofetz Chaim, who is really responsible for opening the Yeshiva Tzran, he also spoke about it. I found this from another source. And he said the Chorban was terrible. Why? But he says, what was the Chorban? Because in Volozhin there were 400 Talmidim then. And they were expelled from the town. They had to leave. 400 Talmidim had to take a wandering stick in their hands. This is what bothered Reb Tzvi, Reb Hirsch Levinson. This was a tragedy. And he says, instead of Volozhin, other yeshivas grew. They developed a palace, a kodesh. And he said again, like his father-in-law said, it's a good thing they didn't allow them with their child, and so on. And he added that in Germany, where they made shalas, they compromised it with Torah and with the child, with Torah and with the chedesh, as it's called nowadays. So that caused the German jewelry to get longer, and a short time it disappeared, and so on. In other words, they're taking a lesson from the leadership of Elohim, and they're very happy that Elohim goes down and didn't submit to bringing in such a study, and it was tragic and so on, but there. This was the attitude of the rabbis. And now let's see how Rabbi Sabotka Yeshiva reacted to the closure of Elohim. The statement I found, Sabotka, about the closure of Volozhin was made 10 years after the event by Rabbi Chiya Yankov Weinberg. He said, Sabotka inherited the Volozhin Yeshiva closed, and Sabotka inherited its place and its name in the Torah world. In other words, He was just transferred. He said its place and its name. And I have sources to show the Sabotka Yeshiva even on the stated name. What's the name of the Rabbi Yeshiva? Eight Chaim. And for a while, the Sabotka Yeshiva didn't have a name yet then in 1892. So it was just part of the Kavna Kolo, and it became a different, but it didn't have a name. Just Kavna, the Sabotka Yeshiva, took the name Eitchaim. Like it's, Volozhin has been replaced by Sabotka. Why did Sabotka take it least badly? Why did Sabotka not take to heart that Volozhin closed down? In my opinion, the answer lies in the character of the Sabotka Yeshiva. Of the three yeshivas, Tells at that time, and Radin and Sabotka, only Sabotka was a true Musa yeshiva. The altar of Sabotka, the Talmud, as I said, of the Sunna Rizu, was the major Talmud of the Rizu Salanta. So the altar of Sabotka, Musa was a vital factor in Judaism. In 1925, when they wanted to publish the writings of the Simcha Zitzel of Keren, so they asked the author of Sabotka, who was already in Eretz Yisrael, came to Eretz Yisrael, he died in 1927, they asked him if he would write an introduction to this anthology of the writings of the Simcha Zitzel is ready. So he wrote this letter. As for me, the merits of my forefathers stood by me to become acquainted with my master teacher and Rebbe that Simcha Zitzel is speaking about. At the beginning, in my weak eyes, and from the eyes of many of the greats, I beheld the topsy-turvy world when I first met my Rebbe that Simcha Zitzel. But after several years passed, I began to see someone that we had all wandered to the sense of the road. The true light of Torah had not shone on me. And I had traded truth for falsity and good for evil. And the character of Torah for its opposite. In other words, the author of Chabad can look for Torah, for Yiddishkeit, without Musar as being evil, as being the opposite of the character of Torah, being false, and having learned by the Simchas Ditzel, I came to see the light of, the true light of Torah hasn't shone on me for several years until I realized it. And I came to understand that this man, the Simchas Ditzel, the prophet of Yisrael Palanta, preeminent among a myriad, was not a man but a spirit of God that speaks from him. As a result of the merits of his great immersion in and meditation on Torah for its own sake, Torah Lishma. He credited the Simchas Ditzel greatness to learn Torah Lishma, for which one acquires Seichel Zvon Halakim. He attributes the meaning of Simchas Ditzel to the merits of his forefathers, because he had come to that phase of attention in a roundabout providential way. A Talmud of the Kelim Talmud Torah, who was a resident of Kelim for many years, he told me there was a tradition in the town that Reb Finkel, the author of Sabotka, I don't know, Tzvi Finkel, when he arrived in Kelim, he wasn't coming there to learn in Kelim, but he was just there. He was already now a young man. He was considered by the close Talmidim of Reb Simcha Zitzel too worldly and modern to be suited to become a Talmid of the altar of Kelim. Nonetheless, he was perceived to be very talented. They decided to take the chance, and they persuaded him to request permission. This was a prerequisite. In order to go into Yiras Shmuz from Reb Simcha Zitzel in Kelim, you have to get permission. So they came to they persuaded him to ask permission from Reb Simcha Zitzel to attend, to listen to Shmuz. Reb Ziv, the Simcha Zitzel's papa, saw the problem that Reb Finkel altered his way of thinking, which opened the way for him to become a Talmud. Regarding the power of Reb Simcha Zitzel's mitzvot, I'll recount what Reb Simcha Zitzel's son-in-law and successor in Kelim, son-in-law, remember, in Kelim, Reb Hirsch Breuder, he explained the difference between his father-in-law's Kelim, Reb Simcha Zitzel, and his own. What do you say? When one's stomach is diseased, a surgeon is able to cure it by cutting out 3/4 of the stomach. If a specialist is unavailable, the regular doctor will prescribe a very strict diet to enable the patient to continue to live with this condition. He said, Reb Ziv was able through a single shmur to cut out the evil in the individual. Now we learn Torah and Musar, we have shmurs, but the Kelim Talmud Torah is only a type of diet which keeps us going despite our afflictions. But this is the power of Reb Simcha Zitzel, the Rebbe of the Altar Sabbath. Since Reb Finkel perceived the general non-Musar view of Torah in such a totally negative light, it is little wonder that he fought for the ascendancy of the Musar approach with such ferocity. As a result of his deep conviction that Musar is the only true understanding of what Judaism is, and any other approach is the opposite of what Torah seeks. This is why he describes it. The opposite. He didn't relax his concern that Musar be disseminated in the citadel of Torah study, and despite having won his battles in the Musar dispute, the big Musar dispute in 1897, and at the turn of the century, he didn't feel secure in his victory until around 1910. There was a poem written by from Elliot Kaplan. He wrote a poem, I'll just read it in translation, about describing the struggle of the Altar Sabotka from Muslims. And it was written around, I think it was 1912, like, I would say about 2 years after the Altar Sabotka was already felled, and he never had to fight for Muslims anymore. So he writes like this: the spark of the heart of the sage of Israel, speaking about Altar Sabotka, fanned by his hand, guided by the force of his presence, solaced by his moral, angered by the rebellion of his challengers, constrained in the cry of his pain, is carried atop the storm in a desert of exile and wandering. This is the way he describes the fight of the Alter Sabbatke to promote the study of the Muslim, the Derech HaMuslim. And even Rabbi Yeshiva, with the Chafetz Chaim, was not a Muslim Yeshiva in full sense. It is described in a book by Yisrael Zifu, the big Bar Musa. Yeshiva Rabbi was conducted all the years according to the old methods of the youth of his founder, the Chafetz Chaim. With his innocent heart, he believed that he would always succeed in running the yeshiva by that system. But the Alter of Sabbatke, the ingenious expert in the field, whose pure eyes glided over the pattern of all those many yeshivas, saw and realized it was impossible. In the modern world, because modern world, it was impossible to maintain the old type of firm type that the Chafetz Chaim represented. Therefore, he constantly made plans how to exert influence on the administration of Yeshiva Sarabim to introduce the correct arrangement of the Musa system. His main method was sending the best force to the great and the Torah and Musa from among his training to study the Rabbi Yeshiva. There was a live spirit in the Yeshiva. He served them officially as Rosh Yeshiva and Musa motivators, Mashpim. Understandably, since they were not appointed officially, their influence was limited. With all this, the Chafetz Chaim avoided bringing in the new methods until the revolutionary spirit of 1905. There was an attempt to overthrow the Tsar in 1905 as a socialist, and then Yeshiva were caught up in it, and then Rabin found any more involved, like any other Yeshivas. Then the Chafetz Chaim began to cave in. Then the Chafetz Chaim agreed to the Alter suggestion and appointment. The appointment he refers to is Rabbi Yeruchem, who was later Mashgiach in the Mir. Rabbi Yeruchem was a Talmud, Yeruchem the Buddhist, was a Talmud of the Alter of Sabbatke. And the Mashgiach in Lakewood, Rabbi Nassim Vachfogel, told me that he learned in the Mir, that Rabbi Yeruchem, the Buddhist of the Mir, said that everything he got, everything he was, he gained from the Alter of Sabbatke. He learned the Hebrews in a little too, but only for a year or two before 19. Before 1898, when the Alter of Kelem died. But before that, he learned under the Alter of Sabbatke, and he learned, he was his town. So the Alter of Sabbatke told the Yeruchem, the young man, to go learn in Rav. But it didn't last long there. But Yeruchem decided not to return after 1910, because some Talmidim felt that his influence was drawing students away from under the Chafetz Chaim's wing. A Talmud of Rabbi Yeruchem told me that the Chafetz Chaim, like most of the other Torah grades, was actually against Moshe. Now that he was a vehement misnagdim, he didn't approve the entire approach. And this Talmud told me a story that Rabbi Yeruchem told him to demonstrate the difference between the approach, his approach, the Moshe approach, and the Chafetz Chaim's approach. From the time that he was still in Rabin before 1910. The custom in the small town of Rab was that when there was a death in the village, the community members came into the dismemberage, banged down on the Bina to announce when the funeral would take place, and the whole yeshiva would attend. Otherwise, there were a few people to participate in the funeral altogether. The Yeruchem felt that it's outrageous for the yeshiva to cancel a study session for a funeral. And he did away with the custom. And the community members came running to the Chafetz Chaim to complain that someone had died and the yeshiva was not attending the funeral. Chafetz Chaim called in Rabbi Yeruchem and asked him, "My high?" So Rabbi Yeruchem gave his explanation. But the Chafetz Chaim responded, "Chachamim Yisrael of Divreichem, wise men, be careful with your words." And Rabbi Yeruchem was forced to retract. And his Talmud elucidated, for a Mutzarite, be it from the Mary Yeshiva or the Alter Sabotka, the Alter Kelm, to bank on the business, close the Yeshiva, because the Jew had died, was not the way of doing things. Aside from the consideration of Bikul Torah, because the Jahalaka permitted, obviously, because of the time, the author of the Mishnah Berurah approved, but such an act takes away from the entire standing of Torah, cover of Torah, which is a matter that the Muslim movement saw its major duty to promote in modern day. In this book, the Shimon Abra, I prayed before, they, it's a good book because it's almost truthful. When it tells about when Yerucham was in Raven, Yerucham was in Raven, and he left, 80 Talmidim went with him. Must have been most of the Talmidim went with him. And then that's when he joined the meeting. But they make it as if the Rebbe told certain Talmidim not to speak to the Chofetz Chaim, and they interpret it to mean that not to disturb the Chofetz Chaim. But the pshat is different. Because it is these Talmidim might be influenced by his outmoded approach to the Yiddishkeit of the front guy. And he said, Bachan that were, they had the more, sophisticated outlook, they wouldn't be hardly speaking to the Chofetz Chaim. But other boys, well, they shouldn't speak to the Chofetz Chaim, because then they wouldn't get the chinuch that the Muslim movement that he is represented in the Muslim movement was providing them in order to maintain their Yiddishkeit in the modern world. I prepare that the hour is late to speak also about the Bishras Lanser himself. The time doesn't permit it. The Alter Sabotka studied under a Talmud of the Bishras Lanser. The Alter Sabotka himself revealed to my father's brother-in-law, the Andrzejewski, that Moshe was not infallible by him until he had once a meeting with the Rishon Lezion in 1882. In 1882, a year before the Rishon Lezion died, it was the only time the Alter Sabotka spoke to the Rishon Lezion. And after he spoke to him, Moshe became infallible. Which is very interesting. Now, Balozhin, how did Balozhin Yeshiva react toward Musa? I'm speaking about the later years of Balozhin Yeshiva. One of the Bishras Lanser was already on the scene. I think about 1890, after the Bishras Lanser had even died already. Well, let's speak about 1870s, 1880s, until 1890. How did they take to Musa? First of all, I want to show how both the Netziv, the main Rosh Yeshiva, and Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, they were both anti-Muslim. A bacher learning in Balozhin had a proclivity to learning Muslim. They sometimes look into the Mesilat Yesharim. And he brought him into the Seder Tag and he's looking at it. So some bacher told the Netziv about it. And the Netziv came into the Mesmedesh and in front of everyone, mentioned the Talmud, not to waste his time thorough, but he read the Talmud Yisrael. This was the Netziv. Reb Chaim Sinai related in the name of his father that the Bishras Lanser had once approached the Netziv and offered him to come as Shkiah in the Balozhin Yeshiva. And the Netziv told him, you're welcome to come, but if you come, the Bishras Lanser was one of the greatest heads of the Gaon in Talmud too. He was one of the greatest in the century. So he said, you're welcome, but if you come, I'll be forced to leave the Yeshiva. This was the chief answer to Bishras Lanser. Who can be the child he's forced to? So of course, this cost for Bishras attempt to personally inject Mercer into the Balozhin Yeshiva. But he tried to get some other person engaged there. You know. But the Netziv wouldn't hear of it. In order to prevent Moshe from coming into Balozhin. And And there's a famous story about Chavitza Tepelburga in the second town that I mentioned about the first one. He came to Valozhin in 1881. Came to Valozhin and he offered to become Mashgiach there. And there's a whole story which I heard three versions about, but I say they're all three true. I heard from Rabbi Nechemi Goldberg. Rabbi Nechemi Goldberg is the son-in-law of the late Shemazaman Arba. He told me the version that he heard from the different lines of coming back from here. And he must have heard it from the Buddhist, yeah. That came into the office to become a Shia and Yeshiva, and he was turned down. This was after he left his rabbinate position in the capital of Russia, in Petersburg. And he was turned down. He had permission to stay at Russia, to stay at Yeshiva. And he got permission. So what did he say? He said the anti-Mussar argument is that the Gemara says, I created a Yetzirah, and I created an antidote. Torah, study of Torah. This is the antidote to the Yetzirah. If you need the Yetzirah, throw it into the Besmedesh. In other words, study Torah, that will destroy the Yetzirah. So the Bitzel rejected this argument. This is the anti-Mussar. You don't have to study Mussar. Learn Baba Kama, learn Edelman, your soul will be vanquished. And he said, he compared it to the two ways of backing the Yetzirah, to the study of Torah, or to the exercise of Muslim, to the two ways of treating an ailment. There is a segula, an occult practice, advocated by a mystic, or a medicine prescribed by a physician. In those years, it's a common thing that you use a segula as a psychic how to cure things. The segula remedy will not have any effect unless it's carried out painstakingly to the last detail. If an incantation is ordered to be repeated 7 times and you repeat only 6 times, it's worthless. Why? If it's a medicine or a refuah, even if it's taken a smaller dosage than the doctor described, it'll help somebody. Get some measure of relief. Likewise, he said, studying Torah is a segula for attaining Yir HaShamayim, while Mussar is as a fool, is a mess. He said, the study of Torah is imperfect, like on Torah of faith, studied not with a foolish lishma. Then the prescript of the Talmud of combating this villain, the Yitzhara, who the study of Torah is futile, worthless. Won't work at all. But with Mussar, since it says a fool, it's a medicine. So even if it carries out the purpose, but as much as you'll take of it, it will help. It will help someone to a degree. Reb Chaim Soloveitchik stood outside of the Smedish, and when Reb Itzhak walked out, he told him, he gave a very good speech, but I want you to know that we at the Lushan are not sick. This is one story. Another story is written by Rabbi Yosef ben Soloveitchik. Your Rebbe's Rebbe. Your Rav's Rebbe. In Isha Halacha, he states that the debate was as follows. Rebbe proved that Mussar was more effective than the study of Torah, because it's another Chazal, which says, a person should try to engage the Toshu and should stand to engage the heart. If he overcame the Yetzirah, fine. If not, he should study Torah. If he won over him, he vanquished him, fine. If not, he should read Kriya Shema. If he won the battle, good. If not, he should remember the day of death. So you see from there that study of Torah is a way to battle, but it's not the final way. There are better ways. There are more effective ways. Like what? Like Kriya Shema or Yom HaNitzach. Which are, that he understands to mean, the study of Mussar. That's the last resort. So Reb Chaim argued that studying Mussar should be used only if the other ways are ineffective. This order of the Gemara, try this, and why? Because Mussar, he said, is like castor oil. For sick people, it is healing. But for the hay, it is sickening. That's what he said. In other words, try another method comfort. If it doesn't work, it means that you're sick. So then you paint the castor oil. Then you say, and the, remember the Yom HaMitzvah. And he said, we have Pelushim, I thank God it helped you. This is this story of the dialogue between Reb Issel, the Baal Musar, and Reb Chaim Pelushim, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, the anti-Muslim. And the third story is that he said it's Russia, and when the Nasi found out the purpose of Reb Issel's visit in the Pelushim, he chided in a rebuke, and he ordered him to leave the city. Short and sweet. This was, I say, all three are true. First was, like I said, the order that I told you. First, he said a speech, and he said that the Musar is the real Lefua. It's not a Sgula, it's a study of Torah, but this is a Lefua for the So the Rav Chaim Soloveitchik told him, the yeshiva is not sick, it's not different than the school of four, the yeshiva is not sick. Then the Nitzi said, then the Bissel said, yeah, but maybe there are some sick boys in the yeshiva. Fine, the yeshiva generally is healthy, doesn't he? But there are some to study Muslim, they have those boys. So that's when he said, it's a castor oil. That's for the sake of healthy, it's good, but for the healthy, most of the boys now, for the healthy, it's awful for them to learn Muslim. This was the second part of the debate. And the third one was that the Nitzi, who obviously was out of town when the Bishop came, well, this was 20 years younger than the Nitzi. The Nitzi was born in 1837, and he was born the Nasi was born in 1817, and he was born, Abish was born in 1837, and he came back from wherever he was, and he found him, and said, what are you doing here, you Muslim? Get out of the Lush. But anyway, the Lush was against Muslim, and therefore, I say furthermore, this visit took place in 1881. When was the Sabbatki Yeshiva founded by the Agra Sabbatki together with the help of Reb Issel, the disappointed guest of Elohim, in 1882? Because of what happened in Elohim, he realized Moshe is not going to enter the Yeshiva world through Elohim. We have to build our own Yeshiva. Because of that episode, the Sabbatki Yeshiva was built as an antithesis to Balashim. And Sabbatka saw itself as the antidote that Balashim, as Balashim was the ailment. It is no wonder that when Balashim closed, Sabbatka was relieved. The anti-Muslim bastion had crumbled, and the Torah would now be taught in collusion with Musar, and Judaism would be saved. Sabbatka didn't mourn the closure of Elohim, it was relieved.
Or on the other hand, why did the other shoes not have to close? if secular studies, if you start in secular studies, what is such a bad thing? Why the yeshivas not?
I mean, why the government wasn't after the other yeshivas,
yeah,
which also didn't have secular studies? Why did they pick Kolozhin? If you're going into a broad subject, but when Reb Chaim Soloveitchik said that Kolozhin is all healthy, he was absolutely wrong. Because in Kolozhin itself, there were a lot of Talmidim who would secretly read outside subjects and study outside subjects. As a matter of fact, Bialik, Nachman Bialik, who came from the Shittabim to study in Kolozhin, he came around 1889. So in Kolozhin, in Shittabim, a long time, he had heard that Kolozhin is a stepping stone to Berlin. And in other words, he thought, coming to Kolozhin, not to learn Torah, but to learn other studies. And in that way, he becomes educated in outside studies. And he writes in his memoirs that when he came to Kolozhin, he started only learning Torah. Why? Because the one who was studying that site was all in secret. They wouldn't let in a stranger. So the Yalik writes that he got into learning, and he got so much into learning, I have to tell you, that when you read this, you find that nowadays it would say, Unifras. Unifras in Kolozhin. And then he wrote a letter to his friends, and the different Chaim Nachman, I stronger all these things, I see for myself, banging the future and Rabbonis, he became, but then he regressed, and he turned to his own self. Anyway, there was the maskilim in Rabbonis, and the son of the Nitzin. The Nitzin had a son, who was born in 1880, in his old age. He was 12 years old when Kolozhin closed down. The mayor of Berlin, who changed his name to Bar Ilan. Bar Ilan University, named for the son of the Nitzin, the mayor of Berlin. So he writes in his book, From Kolozhin to Jerusalem, he has a book from Jerusalem. So he writes, he says, as long as there's only outside forces who wanted to bring secular studies into the leadership, but there was no problem. They managed it, they bribed this official, whatever, they got away with it. But when students from within were undermining the yeshiva, so it was hopeless. And that's why the other yeshiva didn't suffer the persecution of the Russian government and the Russian government. But in the improved edition, I call new documents that were brought to light, Russian government documents. You know, we Jews have our own attitude why the Russian was closed. We have this letter and we have that letter. But what is the coming? Who closed the Russian? What did they have in mind? We don't know. We didn't know. But I want to tell you, going aren't as stupid as they look. The going had released, and the official documents that were uncovered recently, after my first book, my unapproved edition was out, until another one tells a new story altogether. But you'll have to read my approved edition. It's only, I tell it up in Yashiva, I don't tell it in America. I'll tell you the truth. I was sitting there with his son, with my son. His grandson was there. I met him many times after the so he got to know me. So I said, the Rav doesn't have to mix in because there was a son growing in America. I said, the Gdelim over there, let them take care. So I saw from his body language that he was like taken aback. And my son noticed it too and walked up. Why? Because he's the governor for America too. What am I telling you? But since I said I'm only telling in America, I'm only telling in America. Yes.
My brother said that part of the book or the anti-mentor was the fact that it was so wrong. But it
Whether what?
Whether yeshiva should stress the joy of, or the joy of life as opposed to stressing the
intellectual.
That's also part of the stress.
That's part of the derech of musar. Derech of musar is that you have to build up the person, not only make him knowledgeable, you have to develop his personality. This is a condition of the musar movement. And this, I hope, is what God has commanded, that the way he viewed Yiddishkeit before he became a Talmud is the opposite of Yiddishkeit. In other words, develop the Yiddishkeit just as a set of rules and knowledge and all that, but not the development of the person as such. So they don't have the real tzura, the real tzura of Torah. This is exactly what the Alter Sadot commands. This is the chiddush of the Muslim movement. And this was the only way the Muslims was able to counteract the modern influences by showing that this person is not only an observant Jew or a knowledgeable Jew, but he's a higher person. A higher person than the general, let's say, the one who isn't involved in Torah. And this was a very important factor of the Muslim movement. Yes.
Is it possible I can make a point? And if you've ever heard anything like this, my great uncle is an Enochul of the Nomagai, and I once asked him that it doesn't make sense. There's so much machlekes between the Hasidim and by the literal world. What's going on? He explained to me the same problem the Vilna Gaon has with the Hasidim, does also have with the Muslims. And the reason being is he said that by the Muslim movement and by the Hasidim, before they even start, there's an alternative motive of a Musa. You know, you're learning out the Pesukim in a certain way to try and fit to better yourself, and learning as well that influences the way you learn. So you learn the Musa Sforim, and the way you learn the Musa Sforim will influence the way you learn the Gemara. And my grandpa said this was one of the big problems that the Vilna Gaon had. Could it be said that they held the same view and the machlokes?
You mean the study of Moshe can affect the type of study of Torah?
It affects the way you study the Talmud. It affects the way you study. And one of the reasonings he said it wasn't a stamazai machlokes. He didn't want the Torah. My great uncle said he didn't want the Torah to be learnt in any other way apart from the Torah itself. No Muslim, no Hasidim, straight the Shah.
I'll tell you, the Torah, learning the Torah itself, I don't see why it should be affected by, you can just say, the time spent in learning Musar or in trying to develop your personality, you could have spent that time reading more, learning more Torah. But as far as the type of learning of Torah, I don't see why the learning of the Musar should affect it. I mean, certainly, when they started learning Musar, they would say, you're supposed to learn it with the stylus and the emotion, all that, but that doesn't have to affect the learning of Shabbat and Shabbat with emotion and all that. It could be the chassidus that try to say that the learning of Shabbat and Shabbat really doesn't bring you close to God. And that would be something that Zohar Gaon would fight against more than the study of Muslim. Yes.
You mentioned that twice the book was banned by something one very clearly knew all the book, and how you banned it. Can you elaborate on what that tells us about this famous ban?
The ban?
The book was banned by something one very clearly knew all the book itself. Right. What does that tell you stuff about the nature of these bans?
Well, and I'll tell you, because my father would hold back from visiting the Moshe Feinstein. Why? He had a question or something to discuss with my father. But just as I said, this my father liked people, liked the shmuz of people, liked to visit people, but he wouldn't visit the Moshe Feinstein. Why? Because Moshe Feinstein was very, very, big masni. He didn't waste a minute from learning. So he felt, he comes in just to speak to him, he's wasting his time from learning. Now, I want to tell you that Rabbi Yashi is a very big masni. When people come to him, so between person to person, gavur to gavur, he's looking for the safer. I never went to do the front yash, I never got to know him. Until actually I had a problem. So he didn't know me, he didn't know who I was. So when a few Yiddikas, just because he's celebrated, when they came to tell him that Nelson Kamenetsky wrote a book, he wrote this, he wrote that, and so on, he didn't know who Nelson Kamenetsky was. So he imagined it. The way they describe the book that I wrote, they probably figured I must be Yom Kippur, and I must be a Kabbalah Shabbat. The way they describe what my book is like. So I said, all right, well, so he signed the letter that they brought to him. But after all that, and after the school later day, so that's why I went to visit him, I went to meet him, I visited him many times, and I got close to him, and after that, if he would have known me before, so when they came first, he would have said, let me come in about Moshe Feinstein, what it says in the book. But when I came to visit him the first time, which was like 3/4 of a year, after the first time I saw him was Elul. These who came out in Teves, and 3/4 of a year Elul, if you recall, Rabbi Yashi became very sick. He was going to the hospital in an emergency, they brought him surgery from the United States. So I saw him 2 days before he got sick. I hope I didn't make him sick. So I found him the first time I met him, and since then, I've seen him many times.
Why wasn't the chair rejected?
It's easier to make a chayav than to retract. I never asked him to retract. What I asked him to just, he should give me a letter that the new book, the improved book, which I had people read and agree that it's been improved, that should have a letter from him that it should be judged on its own merits. Which, not that I'm asking his approval. Yes. And he promised he would give it, but then he backed off. he said the first ones that came to make trouble, they'll say it's no good, and these new people are going to say it is good. I don't have the strength to involve myself. So I said, but one thing, if anybody comes to complain about my book, tell him that you have to call in Nelson Kamenetsky to sit there while they complain. But that's right. And after he told me that, his grandson used to attend out and stand there when people come to speak to his grandfather. After that, I wrote out a letter to all the signatories, and I said, this is what Rabbi Yashi said. I said, I spent time and money in order to improve the book, even though Rav Sherbel said it's kosher, even though Rav Zalayevsky wrote to Rabbi Yashi, said, I see no justification whatsoever. I said, he wrote to ask for this book. But because you signatory gave an issue, I improved it and so on. And I want to tell you what Rabbi Yashi said. Anybody comes to complain, he's going to call me in. So I want you to do the same. And I handed this letter to each one of the signatories. I couldn't hand it to Rabbi Walden, who passed away in New Jersey. But to the others, I and I showed it first to the grandson of Rabbi Yashi while he's standing to see if I'm writing if I understood his grandfather correctly. So now in the letter I write that these Zhulikas came running to Rabbi Yashi before the book even came out, before the improved. They wanted to advance from the improved book. I'm sure they're not into bad, it doesn't make business yet. So I wrote it in the letter here, that they came running to him, and they read to Rabbi Yashi, and he expelled him.
But if they come after the book is written, I want you to call me in. And that's it. And I went to show to give this letter to Rabbi Chaim Kanievsky, who is the son-in-law of Rabbi Yashu. He tells me, Rabbi Nosna, that me, you don't have to worry. Because I don't sign anything unless my father and my tells me to.
I didn't write the Shach.
What?
I didn't write anything about the Shach.
Ah, I'm sorry.
He just said that Reb Chaim is Malden's son and?
And Sandai.
Could be. I have to read the book again. But I know that after that he was afraid even to hold the baby while it was being Mal. Yes.
I asked a question with apologies in advance in case it's inappropriate, but does improve mean, obviously there are things that the Rabbam added to the book, but does it also mean there are things that are missing because of objections that might have been...
The things that were objected to, I explain better. That's what I explain things better. Maybe I change the language. Let's say people misread the word, like I spoke to someone, someone described the difference between the Netziv and Reb Chaim Soloveitchik. So I wrote the perceived difference. That's where the Netziv was the Tzar, was tough, he was autocratic, and Reb Chaim was friendly and all that. So I say the perceived difference. But the people who read the book don't know what the word perceived. As a matter of fact, one of the people of Kenshi Rabbi Yashu, to come out against my book, told my brother-in-law that he wasn't able to read the book without a dictionary on his side. So I explained better what I mean by perceived. So something when I know some students didn't look at it that way. Now there is one thing that I omitted for a different reason. Because that person stopped speaking to me. The person that told me that story stopped speaking to me after the bank came out against me. So I didn't want to honor him by putting something that he told me in the book. So I admitted it. But I have in the improved edition, I have an appendix which lists all the pages that were changed and the nature of the change. So there's only one omission. That the omission is pertaining to the Rabban Chakia. That I write about the Rabban Kotel, when somebody used to ask in the middle of a shiur, which I used to wipe the floor with them. Like he would say, you're speaking like a drunk Turk, or you got to go back to kindergarten. He would say, so one time he was speaking in England, and somebody interrupted his shiur, somebody with a red beard. So he asked one question, another question. And finally the Rabban said, be quiet, Tova, do both. Now I was criticized, how do I write such things that he spoke to people so freshly? Or the Beis HaGaon used to say, you speak like a shaykh. He said, how do I write about it? So I said, who considers this? Who holds more of Gedoli, me or you? You say that they don't have to act in the way you like them to act. But this time, this didn't happen one time. This is constantly going on. It wasn't a one-time failure. This is the way they said this year. So you say that you know better. So who holds more of Dublin, me or you? I say the way it's done with it is the way, is a valid way of doing things. And you say that I have to do it your way. You say, who holds more of Dublin, me or you? So that's why I admit it. But the points I brought up are the same. The way you used to speak, like a Turk, like a drunk Turk, and one the Talmud once asked about, what do you mean a drunk Turk? Once asked him, I'm poor. So he said like this, somebody is drunk, he doesn't know what he's saying, but we know what he's saying. A Turk knows what he's saying, but we don't understand the language. But if he's a drunk Turk, neither he knows what he's saying. Yes.
I'll tell you, there's one person here in the audience who can answer that question. And he's upstairs in the Ezra Knesset. I have to get my wife's permission.
Is the rug writing?
I have a lot of material on it. And I hope the Ezra Hashem. The Ezra Hashem and the Ezra Knesset. Yes.
Two questions. Really publishing about the book, and second question, perhaps I'm reading, I'm looking a little bit too much into the Rav's words, but the Rav mentioned that the Rav Moshe has learned from Shlita, that his reading of the Rav's book is his teaching, is this referring to a tone of the car sort of thing, or the Rav's fan of other books?
When I hear the word Tikkun, I mean, he never sinned against my mother. Right away, as soon as it dissolved, those people is pervaded. So he said to people, go buy it. He said, right away, I just see you use the word Tikkun, they say Tikkun Shavuot, or Shandrava. This is the way he spends the Shandrava night. As far as you say Tikkun for other books, but again, I'll tell you, Rav Sternberg told me, you know, my brother, Rav Shmuel Shulita, he's really the governor of America, and I took my father's position after my father died. So he didn't retract his approval of the Slifton book. Now, Rabbi Sternberg is against the Slifton book. So he told me, he says, until the story of the Slifton book, so you were the Boshe and your brother was the Tzaddik, and your brother's the Boshe and you. You need the address above Ken. The Adam Sabbath didn't say everybody's wrong. He said that the Mishra Salanta was right. And the Mishra Salanta Saminim were right. He was right. But you have to realize that Avraham Avinu said everybody's wrong and I'm right. Avraham Avinu said that already. When a situation arises, like when the world opened up to Jews, the Jewry has to face a new situation. You have to have people who would be revolutionary and say the old way would be ineffective now. Like the Chavad, why don't you think about the Chavad Chaim? The Chavad Chaim himself, you say, how can I say the Chavad Chaim was not right about Moshe? Chavad Chaim was just a big tzaddik and so on and so forth. But the Bava Moshe considered him. He was truly the big scientist, but this was the old world for the news. He didn't go along with the changes, and he had to go along with the changes. Of course, nowadays we have a whole society, a radio society, that just refuses to look at the outside world. Okay, maybe it's a big enough world that it can exist by itself. But in Lithuania, that wasn't the situation. People couldn't just block out the world from themselves. They have to live within the world. And in order to live within a different type of world, a different kind of society, you have to have people who would say, this is the right way and insist that their way was right. That's a Brahma Bhima. The fighting? You obviously notice that I have problems with this. Now, if you ask me, was the contenders
the fact that the size of him was a promise and anti-Muslim was a good. So I say, of course, it would have been good if everybody would have been pro-Muslim. Yeah. But I don't say that the fight itself was good. But I will say that there were certain people who didn't see the light of Muslim. They didn't see the light, they didn't see the importance of Muslim. And they found on the contrary. Maybe it's wasteful at times. And maybe they shouldn't have Muslim. What do we need it for? But I'm saying, but the people I agree with the people who realize that it was important, not only important, but it was vital. Vital for the continuation of the of Yiddish.
Back to the closing of the letter. Rav mentioned the different camps in the yeshiva supporting the for the Chaim Soloveitchik versus Chaim Berlin, the type of the yeshiva. Between the Chaim Soloveitchik and the Chaim Berlin, between themselves and their own relationship, was there peace between them? And along with that answer, what attempts were made during the whole Tzitzul to really keep the yeshiva together?
I'll tell you, you're touching on a point which I touched on in the old book and in the improved edition because of the release of the government papers. I wrote my book, but there's no evidence whatsoever that your Chaim Soloveitchik himself was personally involved in the Mahalach. Now, according to the government papers, they say there, I have to, in order to answer your question, I have to tell you what the thrust of the papers are. The thrust of the papers, the reason why the Russians called the yeshiva was because of the anarchy within the yeshiva. They were afraid that this will spawn anarchy. And the Russian government was afraid, who knows what they'll do now with the Tsar. They'll say the revolutionary, the anti-revolution constantly against the whole Russian system. So they were afraid. And they write in there that if there'd be another Jewish group that would take over the yeshiva from Berlin and Soloveitchik, they'd give the yeshiva. They only use the secular studies as an excuse. And in the old book, I prove it must have been. I don't understand it. Because they wanted the yeshiva to have 9 hours of secular studies and 3 hours of gemara. It wasn't a question of bringing in 3 hours of secular studies and 9 hours of the morning. Where the yeshiva might have been along, that's going to be a yeshiva with secular studies. They wanted to change it from a yeshiva into a university with Jewish studies. Of course it couldn't be accepted. So this whole thing that was called because of the Mizrach, that if you know the facts of time, it couldn't be because of that. The Russians, they wanted to close it, that's what it was. Why? I didn't know until I saw the government papers. The government papers say, because of the anarchy going on. So then, in those papers, they do accuse Chaim Soloveitchik of being involved, but in an underhand way, in a sly way, and all that. But I say, the official must have been told that by some of the students who didn't want to Chaim Soloveitchik to become the yeshiva appointed by the government. So therefore, they said, now he's behind him, he's making himself. The Chaim Soloveitchik is the one who made sure that the Eschik and Lulav are given back and had his windows broken. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik was 20 years younger than Rav Chaim Berlin, and he was an unambitious person altogether. He was an unambitious person altogether. And 20 years younger, he certainly wouldn't have been involved. Maybe he should have spoken up, but I wanted Chaim Berlin to be the Rosh Yeshiva. But he was also indecisive, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. He involved himself in learning, but the students who wanted him to be, not the Chaim Berlin, are the ones who led the Machlokas. There's no evidence whatsoever that between them. As a matter of fact, Rav Chaim Berlin and Simchas Torah picked up Rav Chaim Soloveitchik and told everybody, you're dancing with the Torah Shiva Fav, I'm dancing with the Torah Shiva Fav. He knew Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. Thank you very much.
And you don't think it was going for an hour and a half straight.
Do you have a calendar?
Sure. Okay, we'll put on Arabian. Okay, put the link out.